Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjublilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. Very pleased to have with me today for University Matters on Campus FM, Dr. André Schwierep. Dr. Schwierep is a lecturer in the Department of Physics within the Faculty of Science. I'm going to give our readers a little potted bio of what Dr. Schwierep does. He first graduated in 2007 from the University of Malta with a BSc Honours degree in Mathematics and Physics. By the end of his course, he had already spent a summer working on modelling nuclear fusion reactors in Finland and on assisting with the construction of the detectors of the compact muon solenoid experiment in CERN. And if I've pronounced that badly, he'll correct me later. In September 2007, Dr. Schwierep left Malta for the UK, where he spent the next 3.5 years working towards his PhD in physics, under the supervision of Dr. Tim Freegard at the University of Southampton. His PhD work was intended to be an equal mixture of theoretical work as well as experimental work, but it was during this period that Dr. Schwierep came to understand that his natural predisposition was towards theory. He successfully defended his thesis in March 2011. 1 month before his thesis defence, he took up a postdoctoral position in Hanover, Germany, with Professor Clemens Hammerer, promising young Austrian quantum physicist. Professor Hammerer introduced him to much of what he uses daily in his work now on quantum mechanics. After 8 months in Germany, Dr. Schwierep was awarded a 3-year research fellowship from the Royal Commission for the Exhibition of 1851. I know about that fellowship.
Yeah, very, very few people do.
Sounds really interesting. During this time, he was mostly based at Queen's University in Belfast, where he worked closely with one of the UK's rising stars, Professor Mauro Paternostro. Surrounded by Sicilians, he felt right at home in Belfast. The commission organises several events and meetings, and André once had the chance to explain his work in quantum mechanics to Princess Anne, and I'm sure he did a very, very good job of that, as we shall see as the interview continues. In 2013, he was awarded an affiliate lectureship at the University of Malta. At the end of his fellowship in September 2014, André became a full-time member of staff in the Department of Physics, where he lectures in quantum mechanics and atomic physics. Since the start of his PhD, André has published over 30 articles in international academic journals, spoken at many conferences all over the world, and lectured in Brazil, Finland, the UK and Malta. Welcome to the programme, Dr. Schwierep.
Thank you. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
I shall slip into calling you André, I'm sure, because you're one of our young lecturers. So
I'm not one for titles anyway.
You won't mind, I'm sure. So, questions about quantum physics. Well, I think I might as well take the bull by the horns and immediately ask you to talk about the work in which you're engaged. The object of most of your research work, I have read, is optomechanics within this wonderful world of very, very tiny things. So do tell us about it.
So in a nutshell, what we do in optomechanics is imagine we have very, very small mirrors on springs. Okay, so these mirrors can vibrate back and forth. And they're very, very tiny. Now, we shine light at these mirrors, and because they're so small, light can actually push them around quite violently. And once you do that, once you have this situation, you can use this light to change how the mirror moves and manipulate it in specific ways. And one thing we do to these mirrors is we cool them down. So I'll explain this in a second. But once we cool them down, what should happen, and what doesn't always happen, is that the sort of quantum mechanical weird nature, and again I'll get onto this in a second, starts coming out. So what I mean by this weird nature is that we have the possibility of seeing the mirror in two places at the same time, for example, which is not something we usually see with mirrors or anything large. The object, let's say one of the objects of this line of research is trying to figure out when this stops working. So when things are very, very large, so ordinary mirrors, the watch I have in front of me at the moment, people, we never see people in two places at the same time. We never see watches in two places at the same time or telling two different times. And This is due to what we call classical mechanics. So it's the laws that govern the world around us as we see it every day. Now, when things are very small, those laws change a bit, and they do allow things to be in two places at the same time or show two times at the same time, so to speak. And we don't really know actually where one world changes into the other world. So we don't really know how small something needs to be in order to show this behavior. And this is one of the objects of our field of optical mechanics. It's trying to figure out exactly where this crossing over between the very small and the very large happens. So it's been probably around 10 or 15 years now since people really started looking at this seriously. And we're still at the level of not knowing whether the experiments need to be improved or whether we've hit a barrier imposed by nature. So it's quite an exciting time because developments happen pretty much on a weekly basis now.
If you find this holy grail of the point at which things actually change, how will that change things?
Okay, so I'll try and answer that in a few different ways. So at the moment, we know quantum mechanics explains pretty much everything we see at the small scale. We have some ideas some very, very good ideas for how it changes into explaining what we see at the large scale. But as I said, there's this gray area where there are still some question marks. And whereas we might think of them as being some academic question marks, the point is that if there is something else in there, in that region, which we're not yet aware of, that does change how we explain how the universe works. And okay, that's of academic interest, but the flip side of that is that we're seeing lots of technologies being miniaturized. So computer chips are now very, 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 very small. They have features on the scale of 10 billionths of a meter nowadays. And once you start getting to that level, even ordinary computer chips need to take into account the effects of quantum mechanics. Now, if we figure out that there is something else that needs to be taken into account, then we can either use our new knowledge to make better chips by avoiding pitfalls, or can actually exploit those new ideas that we found to make better computer chips, for example. So that's one way of seeing it, and the other is it's just nice to know how the world works.
Absolutely, the laws of physics have been sort of a mantra for so many years, and you're really crossing that barrier.
Yes, we are, and also there is some other interest, and actually this there's an intersection between my interests and those of some other people working at the university here. So I look at things at the small scale; they look at things at the scale of the universe. So cosmologists and astrophysicists, and there is a huge problem in physics in that quantum mechanics does not work well with relativity. So the way we describe small things does not at all work well with the way we describe things at the scale of the universe. And knowing whether there is something else to quantum mechanics might be the first step towards putting those two things together.
Perhaps you could give us a very, very potted history of quantum mechanics, in the sense that who were the leading lights, shall we say, in its development?
One of the first ideas came out in the beginning of the 20th century. That was by Max Planck. And he was trying to explain essentially what the color is of something that's glowing red hot. So we call it red hot, but it could actually have different colors depending on the temperature. It could be red, orange, yellow, or white, or something in between. And he was trying to explain exactly what the spectrum of colors is. So when we look at something that's glowing red hot, it looks red. But actually, you can analyze the colors that are coming out of that object, and there will be a distribution of colors. It's not just the one color, red. It's going to be anything from blues to yellows to greens in different quantities, shall we say. Now, this Max Planck was trying to understand this spectral distribution. And he just made the assumption, because nothing else was working, so out of desperation, he made this assumption that light comes in packets. So light does not come in arbitrarily small quantities, but you need, it comes in discrete grains, so to speak. And that assumption explained everything about what he was trying to explain. It was still just something out of desperation, so it was really, really, there was no other reason why he was looking in that direction. And that was taken up by people like Einstein, Max Born, and Schrödinger, so towards the 1910s and 1920s. And they expanded on this idea that the universe has this granularity, and then people started looking at the opposite way. So let me explain this a bit better. Traditionally, so before the 20th century, many people thought that light was just entirely explained as a wave, so like water waves. Max Planck said, but light can also behave as particles. So there's this wave-particle duality. In the 1920s, people looked in the opposite direction, and they said, what if particles, footballs, things like that, around us were also waves? And this is this also comes out of the thesis of a person called Louis de Broglie. I think he was the first person to consider it seriously. And then out of this strange idea followed things like the Schrödinger equation, which then formed the foundation of quantum mechanics in the 1920s. I can't remember the exact date. At first it was a curiosity, so it was just an interesting way of explaining certain phenomena. But then people realized it actually does form the underpinning of everything else that we know about physics, at least as far as we can tell. And yeah, so out of this 1001 completely new innovative ideas came out. So things like lasers wouldn't have been possible without quantum mechanics. Quantum computers, of course, which are still always 20 years in the future.
I thought that was a really wonderful idea, because as you were saying before, things are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. I don't understand anything about microchips, but I read this, and the idea of them getting very small at the quantum level is quite mind-blowing, really. Even I can imagine that that would be a real revolution as far as computers are concerned.
I mean, okay, so there's the size thing, which is also extremely interesting. But what possibly captivates our interest more is the fact that once you get into the quantum world, as I said, things can be in two places at the same time. Another way of seeing that is that a single switch inside the chip can be in two states, on and off, at the same time. Why is that useful? That means that a chip can run through all possible different inputs at the same time. So if I gave you a black box, and you wanted to, sort of a box with an input and an output, call that a black box, and you wanted to analyze how this box operates on inputs. So then you just operate it with 0, operate it with input 1, operate it with input 2, and it gives you some output. Okay, so it could be a mathematical function, it could be something else. With quantum computers, you don't need to do this, because you can just give it all the inputs at the same time, it gives you all the outputs at the same time, and you just run it once. So you get this fantastic speed up. Which sounds interesting, but it's actually quite dangerous also, because it allows us to break all known security methods.
Ah.
That's why there's a lot of interest from the National Security Administration in the USA, for example.
I see.
so there are, and of course then so we create a problem, then we solve it. So there's also a way of using quantum mechanics for creating secure systems that are secure in the strictest sense, so secure because of the laws of the universe, not because of the laws of humanity, so to speak.
In some of the notes that you sent me, which I read with great interest, you talk about cold atoms. And I think before we move on to talking about other things, I was fascinated, so I'm sure the listeners will be. Tell us about these cold atoms.
Okay, so I wrote down in the note, we're fond of saying that we Maltese people don't know anything about cold weather. At least those of us... we don't do cold. Those of us who live in continental Europe know quite a bit about cold. But 0 degrees Celsius sounds like a cold temperature to us. But actually, if we look at the scale that physicists use, so the Kelvin scale, 0 degrees Celsius corresponds to 273.13, I think, Kelvin. Now, when we talk about cold atoms, we talk about atoms which are very, very close to zero Kelvin, so -273.13 degrees Celsius. So that's what we mean by cold and ultra-cold atoms. Now, what's the point with cold atoms? Again, I used an analogy in my notes, which I quite like. It's much easier to take a picture of an elderly couple moving slowly than it is to take a picture of a sprinter, so Usain Bolt or someone like that. The point is that when we take pictures, and I'm using my words sort of as an analogy, but when we take pictures of things that are moving fast, we tend to lose some of the details. And especially if they're moving fast in every possible direction, things get a bit blurred out. If we slow things down, then all the details come out. And in the case of atoms, we can look at the what we call the spectral features with much greater accuracy, which allows us, for example, to build fantastically accurate clocks. And to do this, we need to, as I said, slow these atoms down, and that corresponds to making them cooler. So for a physicist, cold means slow and hot means fast.
Let's move on now to some of the work that you do in promoting your subject. This is something that you're very interested in, I know. Yes. And you've invited world-renowned scientists to talk about their work and attracted quite large audiences. Mm. And your past guests have included Nobel laureate William D. Phillips and distinguished professors Professor Vlatko Vedral and Professor Anton Zeilinger. Tell us about their importance and their impact on the Maltese scientific scene, why you thought it was important to bring them along.
I look at it from opposite ends at the same time, so quantum mechanics, right? One of the reasons why I bring people like this over is to put Malta on the international map. So I do have this dream where we have a regular series of talks, the Malta talks or something like this, where we invite distinguished speakers on a yearly basis. And I've already started moving in this direction through these invitations and by organizing these events. And what they serve to do is they serve to bring Malta and the science we do in Malta and the enthusiasm there is for science, because I was surprised by this actually, to the attention of these people who have very, very good academic networks, who are regarded as being the best in their field and who are still very, very influential in science and science policy. And that allows us to have a stronger voice where science is concerned, both on the sort of international level and at the European level, sort of on a slightly smaller scale. Looking at it from the opposite direction, it also allows the public at large in Malta to sort of sample some of the sort of best and greatest science that's being done or been done over the past few decades, but also being done at the moment. It's an opportunity which, at least when I was growing up, we didn't have. So, we were here stuck in this island and there were scientists out there doing crazy stuff and, very, very, very cool stuff. But we could never speak to them or meet them or hear them talk. And I try and provide this opportunity to bring these people over, to expose Maltese people to them. And especially the children who will be tomorrow's scientists, to try and get them enthusiastic in following maybe their footsteps, so we might get the first Nobel laureate eventually.
Yes, that would be wonderful for the University of Malta. Yeah, great.
Yeah, well, yes.
It's a dream. Why not?
And of course, this allows me to sort of establish networks with these people. And for example, last year during one of my atomic physics lectures, it was actually held via video conferencing with Professor Phillips. So the students had a Nobel laureate giving them a lecture. They could interact. It was a two-way discussion, and that was fantastic. So if we could do this sort of thing more often.
And you yourself actually do promote your subject here in Malta, mm-hmm. by participating in talks yourself. You've been in Think magazine, and you really feel that it's necessary to put your ideas across and that it's a valuable thing. I've been to one of your talks in Science in the City, although I can't say I came away understanding quantum physics, of course. I was certainly enthused by it, and if you only understand how complicated it is, it's also has a value, I suppose, as well.
Yes, it does. And I mean, I always say this during my talks. I don't expect people to understand all of what I'm saying. I just want to give a flavor of what the subject is about, all the interesting things that are going on in the world of science at the moment. Yes, since I was a young boy, things have improved. So the Discovery Channel, for example, does transmit things which are current. But I think there's a huge value in bringing to the public things which are going on at this very moment. You know, what did I work on last week or, you know, a few months ago? And that's the sort of thing which I try and bring forth in my public talks. And that's an opportunity which, again, it's not something we have too much of an opportunity to do. These weren't talks which were popular when I was young. So it's something which I'd love to do just to, again, let people know what kind of science is going on, let people know the interesting research is going on, and the fact that we're not just a small island doing nothing, but we're actually very well connected academically. We've got some pretty good researchers, and I like sharing that with the public. Ultimately, the taxpayer pay my salary, so it's my duty to do that as well.
Well, it was certainly a packed room. It was in the top floor of a restaurant in the middle of Valletta, with people having coffee and having a drink in their hand, and although I kept my mouth tightly shut, other people were actually reacting very much to what you were saying, and so it was really a pleasant occasion. Regarding research, you were talking about the importance of telling people about what you're doing. Let's pass on a bit to the EU funding processes. And I know that they have been criticised for being too application-based, and I remember attending the kickoff session in Brussels, I think it was 2007, when there was the funding tranche, the first funding tranche, and I happened to be there. And this argument about what type of research should be funded was already being brought up there, and apparently Horizon 2020 is also suffering the same criticism. Perhaps you could explain the difference between the so-called blue skies research and the more applied research, which is sometimes demanded by these funding opportunities, why they are both important to science and particularly to your field.
Okay. Well, of course, they are both important. And, well, maybe one way of explaining is, and again, so with reference to my field, let's talk about cold atoms or even optical mechanics, for example. A lot of the improvements that have been made over the past 10, 15 years, I mean, there are a couple of crazy things that people tried and turned out to work very, very well. But the bulk of the improvements were because engineers working inside the R&D labs of certain companies put lots of man hours in and figure out a slightly better way of making this laser and a slightly better way of making that component. Now, this is the sort of research and development which is extremely important. Without that, we wouldn't have cars as efficient as we have. We wouldn't have computers as efficient. We wouldn't have air conditioners as good as we have, so on and so forth. So it is something which is extremely important and vital. And it is a very sort of very... It's a rather low-risk activity, so out of three of these projects, two of them will work, and you'll get your money back, well, several times over. So this is why companies invest in R&D, this is why governments invest in R&D. So that's one side of things. Let's call that applicative research, okay? I don't like giving labels, but let's give them a label.
Sometimes they're useful.
Sometimes they are useful, yes. Now, on the other side, we have what I call blue skies research. Quantum mechanics is one of them. People started exploring quantum mechanics to scratch an itch because there was this one crazy thing they couldn't explain, and they just said, let's try and explain it. And the development for several decades just happened because people found it fascinating. There was no real ulterior motive to study quantum mechanics. As time went on, it happened that quantum mechanics was the only tool people had to explain certain phenomena. And certain phenomena which were predicted by quantum mechanics wouldn't have been discovered otherwise. And one of these led directly to the invention of the laser. So I was reading the biography of Charles Townes recently, who was one of the creators of the laser. And it was one of these strings of coincidences which spans three or four decades, where he just picked up something that Einstein had written down and said, oh, this could actually work. And they ended up developing the laser, again, as a curiosity. They had some ideas for why to apply it, but it was really just a curiosity at the time.
They didn't know what the outcome was going to be.
They didn't know what the outcome was going to be, and even when they developed the laser, it was called a solution without a problem. So they didn't know what they were going to do with this laser. In fact, I think it was AT&T didn't even want to patent it because they thought it was completely useless. And, you know, nowadays, lasers are everywhere, and they're revolutionizing everything, and, you know, they're in every computer, they're in everything. And this is exactly what I have in mind. So this is when I say blue skies research. It's something which is done out of curiosity or to scratch an itch. To just, you know, maybe it's just because I like working in this direction. Let's see what comes out of it. And sometimes, you know, 1 out of 10 times, 1 out of 20 times, 1 out of 100 times, it turns out that what you find changes everything completely. You know, you invent the laser, or you come up with quantum mechanics, case in point. And I see that there needs to be this fun, this blue skies research, as well as, say, more applied research. Otherwise, we will run out of things to develop and things to improve in the future. So when things, you know, when computer chips shrink to a certain level and they stop behaving as we want them to behave, then we must know what's going to come next. And what comes next is something which was probably discovered 20 years ago by someone who was looking in a completely different direction. And yes, these things are more high risk, so out of 20, maybe one of them will succeed.
More serendipitous, sort of.
Yes, but that's just the nature of the game. But then that one thing which succeeds will give you a lot more back, even financially and even, you know, in every other sense. So it's high risk, high gain sort of thing. And I do believe there's a place for both of these. Now, the problem is that the EU funding mechanisms at the moment don't quite allow for this. They really want every single project to have both short-term and long-term goals, but they really just care about the short-term. I've heard this being said by one of the evaluators. And at that point, people like me, you know, we try and sort of mold our applications to fit this pattern, but that is stifling innovation. That really is stifling innovation. And in fact, countries like the UK and the Netherlands have already started investing themselves in more blue skies research. But there are, we believe there are other alternatives. So, for example, instead of looking on a project by project basis, why doesn't the EU, for example, fund a certain field and then allow the risk in that field to sort of balance itself out? So let's say we found quantum technologies as a field. Some of those projects will be blue skies and, you know, very, very risky. Some of them will be very low risk. But you don't need to have these two kinds of risk in the same project, because that's really what's stifling innovation. So there are yes, improvements that can be made to the system. We're working in that direction.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to end up with with that comment, a very valuable one. I'd like to thank Dr. Andrzej Shwirep for coming on University Matters today to talk about quantum mechanics. Thank you.
Cheers, thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye. Il-programm li għadkom kemm smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.